first of all, I have to have two or three little sort of rejoinders or qualifications tonight, since we're dealing with a topic which deals with politics. I am neither on the payroll of the Republican Party nor of the Democratic Party. First of all, we have to say that, because it might be that since I'm talking about Carter, some people might think that, I support him. On the other hand, after you hear what I'm going to say, you might think I'm hired by the Republicans. Sort of the plumbers are back in action again, but this is simply not the case. And let me say further that, it's probably just stating the obvious, but that you will have the opportunity from now on until November to decide, obviously, for yourself about the candidacies of the two major parties, and I would only ask that you not make up your mind on the basis of what we're going to talk about tonight. I mention that because once I prepared a book on the ultra-fundamentalists in the churches, people like Carl McIntyre and Billy James Hargis and Edgar Bundy and the others, and I was challenged to a debate over this particular thesis of mine, and the terms of the debate were that the truth or falsity of what they called the liberal Protestant theology would be decided on the basis of the success or failure of the debate. And in other words, I was there and only my word was to speak for and represent what they called the liberal Protestant tradition. And I didn't fall into that trap, obviously, because they could go away and saying that, well, tonight, obviously, George had lost the debate. That means that the liberal Protestant tradition, as they defined it, simply wasn't valid. So on the base, don't make up your mind pro or con on Carter or Ford or Reagan on the basis of what we're talking about tonight. Okay, so much for that. I think the topic, though, is worth exploring in some detail, not only because it's interesting, because it's new, but because I think the time in which we're living right now, the early summer of 1976, certainly is one of the most interesting and one of the most unpredicted, I think, times in recent American political history. Just for instance, just a few weeks ago, would have thought that Jimmy Carter would have been the Democratic nominee? Who would have thought that the incumbent or an incumbent president would be in real trouble so far as getting the renomination was concerned? This is simply unheard of, really, in past American history. Or that the Panama Canal would be a campaign issue. Or that less than one-third of all the total qualified voters in America turned out in the 30 primaries. When you stop to think of that, less than one-third of the registered voters from the age of 18 and up less than one-third turned up for the 30 primaries, it's something to think about. Or in considering the plight of the Democratic Party in 1968 and in 1972, that even before the convention, the Democrat leaders would fall into line as quickly and unite behind one candidate as easily as they did. I was driving along this on June 10th, I remember, listening to all the results, and it was just like, you know, the dominoes all falling in place. Daley, Wallace, Stevenson, Udall, Jackson, just like you got them all lined and pushed, gave the push, and everybody sort of, knew the right place in which to fall, and it was mainly towards South Georgia. Okay. What I'd like to do very briefly is mention a few facts simply about Carter's life, because I'm sure some people don't know some of the basic information. Then I would like to talk a little bit about his theology and his ethics, and I would prefer reading from the manuscript here because I'm not that familiar yet to be able to ad-lib with any great degree of confidence on this. And then finally, I would like to start what I hope will be a good discussion on what the candidacy of Carter, given what we've talked about so far as his theology and ethics are concerned, what that tells us about where we are now. I don't want to talk about the pros and cons of his stand on, for instance, on the Humphrey Hawkins full employment bill. I think that, that wouldn't get us anywhere because I don't think the Humphrey Hawkins employment bill is going to be passed in the first place. It'll get a veto if it does. But that aside, I would rather talk about the broad issues, and especially about the fact, and the most remarkable fact of all, is that we have a man running for from a major party who has a kind of religious commitment and a kind of religious language, the likes of which we haven't heard since the days of William Jennings Bryan. And that goes way back to 1908. Bryan was a candidate in 1896, 1900, and 1908, three times a bridesmaid, and just like Henry Clay a little bit before him. And my junior senator from my state tried, but didn't quite get there this time, but I'll say a little bit more about that also. But the remarkable thing is somebody like Carter coming along with the kind of religious commitment that he has and seemingly going through the difficult primaries and coming up with the prize with as much apparent ease as he did. And what does this really tell us, really, about what we want from our leaders, where we stand now in light of what's happened to our country, you know, in the last few years? Okay. Very briefly at the about his background. He's 51 years old. He was born in the town Plains, Georgia, where he now lives. His father had a combination general store and peanut warehouse where peanuts was the principal cash crop. Carter had an unspectacular youth. There didn't seem to be any great stress one way or the other, in contrast to some of the other presidential candidates in recent years who had some much more difficult childhoods in terms of parental problems and deaths and so on. The Carter family didn't have enough money to send Jimmy to college, and so the only way in which he could get a college education was to enter one of the military academies. And so in 1943, he entered Annapolis and there graduated with a commission and stayed in the Navy for a few years afterwards in the field of nuclear submarines. And probably, as far as we can tell from his autobiography, would have stayed in the Navy as a career, except for the fact that his father died in the late 50s, and Jimmy was the sole heir, really, to the farm and the warehouse, such as it was, and decided, after some pondering, that he should go back home again. And there he returned and took over the family business. In 1962, he ran for and was elected to the Georgia State Legislature. In 1966, he ran for the Georgia governorship and lost. And in 1970, he ran again for the Georgia legislature, for the Georgia governorship, 1970, and was elected to office, being inaugurated, obviously, in 1971, and stayed in office for 4 years. And from the time he left the Georgia governorship until the present, he has been actively and openly engaged in pursuing the nomination from the Democratic Party for the presidency. Okay. Now, let me turn next to his theology and some of his ethics. And I would prefer to make this more spontaneous, but I want to be sure that this is clear, and therefore I'll stick fairly closely to what I've written here. Now, since I've mentioned his religious convictions, some of you might get the impression that what I'm trying to raise here is a question of whether or not Carter in the White House, given his convictions, might raise, you know, a kind of religious problem, such as we had twice before in the 20th century, in 1928 when we had Al Smith running from the Democratic on the Democratic ticket, and also again, of course, in 1960 with President Senator John F. Kennedy. Both were Roman Catholics, and the questions, obviously, that were raised at that time were questions having to do with the questions of separation of church and state, and would he take orders from the Vatican, and would he kiss Cardinal Cushing's ring, and you remember other profound issues that came up at that particular time. Now, what I'm saying is that Carter's candidacy does not raise the same kind of questions, because, as I'll talk about and develop a little bit later, Carter is a Baptist, and no denomination in the United States is more devoted to a rigorous separation and enforcement of church and state than the Baptists. In fact, they virtually invented separation of church and state going back into the Revolutionary period, which is something I want to talk about a little bit later. So when I'm talking about Carter and his religious convictions, I'm not talking about whether or not his candidacy raises the same kinds of issues as did that of Al Smith, the happy warrior, or of President Kennedy just 16, you know, years ago. All right. So without any more talk delay there, let's get to what he really says about his religious faith. We know that he had a strong exposure to traditional Orthodox Baptist teachings in his youth, but demonstrated no particular enthusiasm for a life in the ministry, for instance, throughout his career, although, so far as we know, there was nothing spectacular one way or the other about his youth. His conversion experience didn't really come until 1967, which was when he was well into his 40s. And it came shortly after his bid for the governorship in Georgia was turned back. And he had what we would call a born-again religious conversion experience. And his expression, he is a, quote, twice-born Christian. and can tell us the time that this happened. Now, this means that he, like those who have had this experience, began a new life, a person who was born again when he or she accepts the living presence of Jesus as Lord and Savior in their life. That acceptance results in the forgiveness of sins and the assurance of eternal reward after death. Yet the interesting thing about Carter's experience, as familiar as the language is to all of us, is that it was not especially emotional nor traumatic. It was a very quiet, calm decision made after some months of reflection. In fact, I'd like to read a little bit from his autobiography here about this, because unless you're aware of what happened, it's interesting, in the autobiography, a campaign autobiography, you're not really told that it's a conversion experience. It's in really quite muted terms that he talks about what happens, and you have to really read between the lines and extrapolate rather carefully to understand what happens, and I think is in harmony with the experience. There were no timpani or, you know, canons or anything like this, a very quiet, calm kind of decision. All right. One day I was invited to speak, this was in 1967, I was invited to speak to a nearby church in Preston, Georgia, which is a small town with a population of about 300. The assigned topic to me was, quote, Christian witnessing. I thought immediately that they had undoubtedly heard about the wonderful work I was doing in my own church. When I went into the front room to write my speech about witnessing, it was with some sense of self-satisfaction. About halfway through composing the speech, I decided to make a real impression on the audience. I began to figure out how many individual visits I had made for God. Since it had been 14 years since I had returned home from the Navy, and since I had visited an average of 2 families a year, and assuming 2 parents and 3 children per family, there were a total of 140 visits. I proudly wrote the figure down on my notes and still have it. When I was congratulating myself, suddenly I remembered the 1966 governor's election. It was very late when we decided to make the campaign, so we had to work furiously to overcome the handicap of the late start. I left everything I cared for, my farm, my family, my bird dogs, and my wife, and I spent 16 to 18 hours a day trying to reach as many Georgia voters as possible. I'm just going to read ahead and not ad-lib here at all. We went in opposite directions, shaking hands and telling everybody what a wonderful man I was and why they should vote for me. At the end of the almost successful campaign, we had met more than 300,000 Georgians. The comparison struck me, 300,000 visits for myself in 3 months and 140 visits for God in 14 years. I began to read the Bible with a new interest and perspective and to understand more clearly the admonitions about pride and self-satisfaction. I read again the parable, Luke 18:10 to 13, about the Pharisee who came into the temple and said, God, I thank thee that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, and even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner. Quote, close quote. For the first time, I saw that I was the Pharisee. I began to expand my personal service in the church and to search more diligently for a closer relationship with God among my different business, professional, and political interests. An invitation came for me to go to another state to witness for a week within about 100 families, among whom there were no believers in God. I was told that no special qualifications were required, just the willingness to give a week of my life to God, quote, with no strings attached. After accepting the invitation, I realized that during the more than 30 years of my church membership, there had probably not been 1 hour of total commitment to God with, quote, absolutely no strings attached. It was an exhilarating week, and similar experiences were repeated in subsequent years. And that's the sum total of his description of what happened to him at that particular time. But there's far more to it, obviously, than that, and what I would like to do to explain the sort of the setting in which his statements about his faith and about his principles, so far as his governorship were concerned, is to draw from a very perceptive article from Professor Brooks Hollifield, who teaches American religious history at Emory, of course, which is in Georgia, which is in Atlanta. If you like bibliography here, this appeared in the June 5th, 1976 issue of New Republic. And Hollifield finds 3 distinct historical traditions at work in the Carter faith, or 3 traditions which are available on which Carter draws. And I would like to outline these for you very briefly and then explain some of the reasons, some of the ways in which Carter uses these to move into some of his areas of specific legislation. And the 3, to give them labels, would be, first of all, Southern Evangelicalism, secondly, an 18th century variety of religious pluralism, and third, a sophisticated Christian realism. Now, Carter is a Southern Baptist, and the Southern Baptists are some of the last, is sort of the last repository, I think, of the Puritan tradition in America. Puritans and most Southern Baptists required for admission to their churches a credible narration of conversion, of a unique, unmistakable religious conversion experience. They defined it as regeneration or rebirth. You and I know this so well that I needn't dwell on this. So, to draw specifically then from the 18th century Southern evangelical tradition, what happened was that during the Great Awakening, the first great revival in America, the new lights, those who were converted or had the regeneration experience, demanded that their congregations accept the new life in the church, the new light as they call it, and that all members for the churches be required to make what Hollifield calls a credible narration of their conversion experience. Obviously many churches didn't do this, and as we know, the churches split. The old lights and new lights, many congregations were very sharply divided. Now what happened was that among the new lights, those who accepted the conversion experience as necessary for membership, they usually split and formed separatist congregations. And the point here, and I want to underline this, they formed separatist congregations to cultivate inward piety. That's very important to remember, to cultivate inward piety. The emphasis being on conversion, on regeneration, on sanctification, on growth and holiness. The fruits of the new life, as exhibited here, would show forth a new responsibility. One would now have power lacking before to control anger, lust, pride, and fear. These would be negative drives. One also has power which was lacking before to develop positive drives such as love and compassion. Or let me put this in a little different way here. Lutherans, I think, would speak of the Christian life as a state of being a thoroughgoing sinner and a forgiven saint. A traditional Catholic would think of Christian life as a process of growth nurtured by the visible church with its tangible and omnipresent sacraments. Carter, I think, would phrase it somewhat differently. He speaks of an experience of forgiveness that results in three things: strenuous self-discipline, inner commitment, and introspective watchfulness. His conversion followed the time-honored pattern: a sense of unworthiness, a moment of resignation, an experience of relief, and then, quote in his words, a continuing search in my own heart for a corrective attitude towards my natural inclinations. That's a very important quote. Continuing search in my own heart for a corrective attitude towards my natural inclinations. Okay. So the Southern evangelicalism tradition is one which is very familiar to people in that part of the country, other parts of the country too, but one from which I think, one which we can trace rather clearly from that time up to people such as Jimmy Carter himself. The second major theme, that of religious pluralism, is also one very closely associated with his religious convictions. In the 18th century, we had a sort of a strange combination at work here in states like Massachusetts would be the best state, for example, or Virginia, where we would have deists, for instance, such as John Adams in Massachusetts or Jefferson Madison in Virginia, who very much feared the tyranny of the church. And we also, at the same time, a large number of very active religious sectarians. The best example here would be the Baptist in Massachusetts, Isaac Backus, really one of the great people, I think, in American religious history, is oftentimes underplayed. Just as the deists feared the tyranny of the church, the Baptists feared that the government would corrupt the church. So they were both suspicious of what the other, you know, might do. And these two groups banded together to see to it that the United States had written into the state and the federal constitutions the provisions for no religious test for office and for separation of church and state. And here we have something which I think is a very sort of practical, pragmatic solution to this question of an established faith or of a state church. What the religious sectarians found was that if they wanted to have religious freedom for themselves, the only way they could do it was to allow religious freedom for everyone else. And they didn't do it out of a conviction that all religious beliefs or all religious doctrines, you know, are just as good as another. But if they wanted to have their Baptist or whatever way of life, they would have to allow the same freedom for others. And hence, out of this sort of practical trial and error experience in colonial America, plus some of the deistic thought which shows up in Jefferson and Madison in the 1780s, we get the recognition of the need for religious pluralism in this country. And this shows up in something which I think is fascinating and shows clearly, I think, Carter's recognition of this. When he was a state senator in 1964, he proposed an amendment to remove from the Georgia Constitution the existing paragraph on religious freedom, which specified that every person had, quote, the natural and inalienable right to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience. I'll read that again, and I think you can see right away what's wrong with that particular statement. That every person had, quote, the natural and inalienable right to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience. Carter's substitute was a one-sentence statement, stating that, quote, no law shall be passed respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, straight out of the First Amendment. Carter's point, obviously, was that the original sentence required that God be worshipped. If that's the case, then obviously there is a violation of separation of church and state. With this, and the amendment was struck down, it became known as Carter opposing Christianity and so on, and it never carried too far. All right. The third strand, besides that of Southern evangelicalism and the 18th century religious pluralism, is that of Christian realism. And reporters are entranced, and I was grateful to get a copy here of his Law Day speech, which I want to quote from a little while later, because it illustrates the point I'm making here. Reporters are entranced to find that Carter frequently quotes Reinhold Niebuhr, because you wouldn't necessarily expect to find a Southern Georgia businessman being too familiar with the works of Niebuhr. And many of them have questioned the integrity of Carter in quoting somebody like Niebuhr, because it sounds like he's trying to add some intellectual and theological luster to some of his more simple explanations. But Carter, I think, has absorbed a great deal of Niebuhr and can generally be located within the stream of what we started to call in the 1940s and came into its fruition in the 1950s of the School of Christian Realism. And Carter frequently quotes Niebuhr's Marxism, quote, that the sad duty of politics is to establish justice in a sinful world. Now, by that, Niebuhr meant that both Christian liberals, who sought to realize the kingdom of God on earth through moralism and love, and secular humanists, whose hopes for a future depended on their own optimism about human nature, both of these groups vastly overestimated man's capacity for evil. Niebuhr briefly argued that man's capacity for transcendence, for the capacity to reflect back on one's life and find meaning and purpose there, inevitably produced anxiety and frustration, thus making humanistic optimistic goals seem rather futile and shallow. Further, Niebuhr argued that corporate groups, such as nations and social classes, lack the capacity to sacrifice their own interests for the common good. Thus, a realistic goal for Christians was not the establishment of a loving society, according to Niebuhr, but rather a relatively just order based on the balance of forces. That balance would be regulated by the government, the only agency responsible to the people. Thus, quote, the sad duty of politics is to establish justice in a sinful world. These three points, these three traditions, and I think help us understand the tradition out of which Carter comes. And to be sure, Carter is a practical man of business, of public administration, and he's not a systematic theologian, and I'm sure there would be many here who could find, if we explored this further enough, certain contradictions among these three strands. And I'm sure that's true. The only thing I would say by way of reply is that Carter has never claimed to be a trained church theologian in terms of putting everything together in a systematic form. Now, the question, of course, comes up when you hear his religious language, is whether or not he's a fundamentalist. And this charge has been made, and I can only suggest that in terms of the way I understand the term fundamentalism, Carter would better be placed in the category of what we call new evangelical. That is, a twice-born Christian, in his terms, with strong convictions about social justice, about the church's concerns in the world, and with an openness to research in the sciences and the humanities. His is not the old gloomy, I think, fundamentalist rejection of the world, which was oftentimes judgmental and aloof, but there seems in Carter to be a positive kind of trusting attitude towards the world, a concern with finding and maintaining justice and not just waiting with the hereafter. It's very possible that Carter may be a premillennialist, but it certainly doesn't show in his attitudes towards involvement in this world. But what about new evangelicalism? Now, let me define this very briefly, because I'm going to use this as a lead-in to why he gets so much support from certain people in this country, which has, I think, not so much to do with his politics as it has to do with his religious convictions. New evangelicalism is a rather broad, but I think clear term for large numbers of American Protestants, primarily within the Methodists, I think Baptists and Presbyterians, who are perhaps more loyal to what we would call new evangelical commitments than they may be to their own denominational viewpoints. The best example I can give of what I mean by new evangelicals in this country would be the younger writers who have broken with the older group of Protestants who founded the magazine Christianity Today. That was founded in 1956 by Carl F. H. Henry and others, and after Henry's retirement has been taken over by Harold Lindzel, and represents a certain strain within American Protestant thought, but there has developed in the last 4 or 5, 6 years, primarily as a result, I think, of Vietnam and the issues over amnesty and the draft, and COs and all the rest, a new school of younger theologians and religious spokesmen who are closer to the kinds of ideas and concerns for the world and justice that Carter is than would be the older people, such as Carl F. Henry and Harold Lindzel. And I can only list off a few names here, and for those of you who are familiar with the writings, I think maybe when you hear the names, you'll see the kind of school that I'm trying to identify here. These would be people such as Jim Wallace and Ron Sider, John Howard Yodel, Donald and Lucille Dayton, Richard Quibedot, Richard Moe of Calvin College, and others. These names, I hope, will be somewhat suggestive to you. All right. These people represent as many as we think 30 to 40 million Americans who have never really had their own candidate for president before. And they represent, according to all the commentators I read, the greatest untapped block vote in the country. Now, they haven't been heard about before as an untapped block vote because they've never had their own candidate to run before. One of the interesting things about the 1964 campaign when Barry Goldwater ran was how he was not able to tap this source. For reasons which we don't have to go into here, Goldwater didn't tap the source, and as a result, it didn't become a viable bloc which could be identified as a specific interest group at that particular time. In 1968 and in 1972, I think it's fair to say, with the new evangelicals across the country, they probably voted far more for the Republican candidate than they did for the Democratic candidate, simply because they thought he was a little bit more conservative at that time. But now suddenly this large number of people, somewhere between, we think, between 30 and 40 million, have their own candidate in the person of Jimmy Carter. And they understand what he means about being born again, and why he talks, and they understand why he talks more about moral issues than concrete economic problems. They believe the real issues are faith, morality, and family living, and they like what they hear Carter saying. And it's interesting that when Carter takes what we would call more liberal stance on certain issues, they don't think that this Carter has deserted the camp, or that Carter is trying to, you know, cover all bases. For instance, one other is the fighting issues, and I want to talk about this in some detail Friday in here at 11 o'clock, is the issue of amnesty. And Carter has issued, of course, a proclamation stating that if he were president, he would issue a proclamation of forgiveness. Not total amnesty, because amnesty means forgetfulness, but he would issue a proclamation of forgiveness stating that they did wrong, but they are being, you know, forgiven for this, and that would be the end of it right there. Now, they don't take this, the new evangelicals don't take this as a sign of Carter moving more towards the left, but they take it as proof of his compassion. And they are willing to accept this so far as he's concerned there. All right. And I could go more on that, but it's getting into specific issues, and I'd rather talk more about the broad issues. Now, let me turn briefly here to try to explain as best I can how he gets certain, what we would call ethical principles out of these religious ideas which we've outlined here so far for you. Carter believes that one's behavior and that of a nation should be guided by clear loyalty to specific principles of morality. He has little doubt that we can understand the basic elements of this code of morality, but he would not insist that such principles can be made applicable in only one way. That is to say, by contrast to older fundamentalists who would say there is only one answer to, you know, certain moral dilemmas or moral questions as they come up in this country. His commitment, as we stated earlier, is to establish justice and opportunity, using the power of the government at the appropriate level to do so. Holifield suggests Carter's ethics are interwoven with an understanding of Christian growth. Quote, "The struggle to overcome the self and to love other people as a demonstration of love for Christ." This is why he emphasizes the corrective attitude towards his own inclination. The old-fashioned word for this really is self-mortification. And Carter is openly quite critical of himself, especially after his conversion experience. Here I'll give some quotes. Quote, "I tend to exact too much of myself," quote, "to want to be tough and aggressive and hard." He quotes a Cuban minister, Eloy Cruz, with whom he accompanied on an evangelism mission in Puerto Rico in 1967. Quote, "Our Savior has hands which are gentle, and he cannot do much with a man who is hard. In practical terms, that comes down to faith as being a matter of inward piety and, quote, loving your neighbor by being as just as possible. This seems to be expressed in certain politically unpopular policies when, as senator and as governor, he carried out certain programs that I'd like to mention very, very briefly here. For instance, he devoted himself to prison reform, which was not exactly a popular issue in Georgia at that particular time, and also to the expansion of medical, legal, and educational opportunities to the powerless. He convinced some of his Southern Baptist friends in Georgia to collect funds for medical clinics to be located in the Atlanta ghettos. And specifically about corporate wealth and power, to tie into the Christian realism theme. In his famous May 1974 Law Day speech, I will use a few quotes here. He told his audiences that, quote, the laws are constantly changing to stabilize the social equilibrium of forces and counterforces in a dynamic society, and that the law in its totality is an expression of the structure of government. He criticized the inequalities of the legal structure, quote, in general, the powerful and influential in our society shape the laws and have a great influence on the legislatures and on Congress. One of his closest supporters is Representative Andrew Young, whom some of you remember from the days of Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and Young is now a congressman from the 5th District in Georgia, which is Atlanta, and in an interesting article in the Nation magazine, Young outlines some of Carter's activities in confronting such lobbies as the Corps of Engineers, the real estate lobby, and the highway and the construction lobbies, which had dominated Georgia politics for a long period of time. One last quotation here. There is no inherent conflict between careful planning, tight management, and constant reassessment on the one hand, and compassionate concern for the plight of the deprived and the afflicted on the other. Waste and efficiency never fed a hungry child, provided a job for a willing worker, or educated a deserving child. And so I'd like to move very briefly here and to the third part on what all this means for 1976, and then simply throw it open for comment as long as possible. I think it means, or could mean, that in the United States, the voters aren't all that afraid or turned off by candidates who use explicitly religious language. Not only does Carter do this, but Governor Jerry Brown from California has made no secret of his earlier involvement and commitment to certain ideas. And maybe what Carter has tapped here is something which other candidates have overlooked or have been afraid of talking about for some period of time. At least it's something worth talking about. And I think Carter's candidacy also indicates, and to many people I think this is sort of a minus, that Americans want to have complex issues explained in clear, simple terms. This is why so many people get upset when it seems Carter is not specific. Although it has to be said that Carter has taken specific stands on many issues, but the press is so entranced with this rather unusual candidate coming out that they have played up this far more than they have giving his specific stands on the more complex issues. That is, a lot of Americans want a man who talks to the heart, who is so solid on basic moral commitment, a man whom they can trust. Carter mobilizes that sentiment, and he has turned it into impressive victories in every part of the country. And I think Carter's presidency indicates something about the presidency which Senator Humphrey found out much too late, and that is the presidency is going to go to someone who does go to the grassroots, who talks to the people, and who has dedicated, well-organized forces at work on the local level. That is to say, the mass media does create interest. But solid organization at the precinct level still turns out the voters. And this is what Carter did from the very beginning with Iowa right up to the president. And this is best seen, I think, in Carter's winning largely in blue-collar union precincts, even though it's true that even to today, no local or national union has endorsed him, which is a remarkable kind of phenomenon in terms of simply getting out the vote in certain kinds of precincts. And finally, I think Carter's candidacy suggests for 1976 that Americans that suspect that politics had been taken over by the Wheeler dealers, and they want a personality they can trust rather than familiar faces they can no longer trust, because we were told that you have to have a long exposure on television before people know who you are, and that you can't get anywhere until you've had long exposure. Suddenly we find that people don't want the familiar faces. They want somebody they can, what apparently gets out of somebody they can trust rather than simply the faces that they've seen for a long time. This is really the politics of, quote, anti-politics, supporting a candidate who acts like a non-candidate. Many of us may not approve of this, but we know no president can get anything done until he has public support behind him, even when that public support may not be well informed. In a democracy, public opinion changes slowly, but when it does change, it controls the boundaries of the actions of its officials, and those who survive are those who know how to capitalize on that opinion. In my judgment, that is not tricky or devious, but a recognition of the need to establish and hold a consensus to get anything done. Finally, I think the Carter candidacy suggests the whole political wisdom of the past is under scrutiny. None of the wisdom of such pros as Udall, Jackson, By, Church, Humphrey, or Schopp, or the others, and more, could understand the desires of the American people, as well as did the planners of Carter's campaign. They have found Americans are not really much interested in either party competition or labels such as liberal or conservative. It is very possible that the party structure will be realigned after this campaign. The McGovern people tried to realign it according to the liberal versus conservatives and failed in 1972, but it's altogether possible that Carter may find a new formula to realign the parties, I think, in this country. But whatever else it may suggest at this time is something which I would like to leave for discussion right now, because the amazing thing still is, to come back to my original point, we haven't had anybody like him since the golden-throated orator from the riverbanks of the Platte River in 1908, and that's been a long time in coming. So I hope that opens up enough for commentary on what it all means in 1976.
Erling, do you think that the planners of the Carter candidacy really were aware of all you've been talking about, and the 30 to 40 million voters, or did they kind of stumble into this candidate and into his popularity?
Well, I think, I think Carter has been saying since his conversion experience in 1967 pretty much the same thing about his religious faith and how it affects his interest in public life, and that he's gone straight ahead with this. And what I think is impressive in terms of political management is how certain managers have been able to take the Carter candidacy and match it with the mood of the country at this time, which may be stumbling into something, and it may be simply, you know, good fortune or whatever is at work here, but it simply would suggest that they better understood American public opinion this year than did all the money, for instance, of Governor Schaap. And if any of you are from Pennsylvania, you know that's a whole lot of money, and for all his public opinion research polls and all the rest, he didn't come up with kinds of clues that the Carter people came up with.
What kind of disillusionment do you think would fall across the American people if Carter is elected because of the kind of sentiments that you've talked about, and he turns out to be a flop?
Yeah.
What would that do then to politics and the whole thing that you've been describing here?
Oh, wow, I am not a futurist. For one thing, I think we've learned that the government would carry on, Congress would assume more power than it has now, more leadership and direction than it did in the under LBJ and under Nixon, and by default, really, more than anything else, and that I think American people would become somewhat more cynical, more disillusioned again, and would probably really question whether or not, you know, in a sense, politics could be rejuvenated again. You could put new life and enthusiasm back into it again. I think a large number of people would become fatalists, really, about the whole system, and they would go back to thinking that all politicians are crooks or have secretaries who can't type and so on, which would be a disaster, really. Because
it's a risky kind of candidacy.
Oh yeah, it's a very risky kind of candidacy. Very much, because he's saying, you know, trust me. Mm-hmm. And that's a terrific risk. That's what FDR did in 1932. He certainly didn't have a concrete program, and he had a lot of pizzazz. And he had other things going for him, of course, the Depression and so on.
I mean, Carter's got a spiritual depression going for him.
That's an interesting thing to kick around. You think? there is a sort of a spiritual vacuum in the country? Is that what he's tapping? Sort of sense that, why not? We've tried everything else. Why not try a Southern Baptist? Kind of a fatalism? Sorry? I'm sorry, Carol?
I think we had LBJ in that category.
Yeah.
But hardly a born-again one.
Hardly born again, yeah. He had colorful language.
No way.
Any glimmer here, I'll call on somebody if I see a hand.
Could I?
Sure, Evelyn.
Do you see his conversion experience affecting his global view in any way?
He hasn't talked. This is one area where I would like a good deal more information. He hasn't talked a great deal about foreign policy. He's talked about détente and things, but he hasn't talked a great deal about it. And of course, he's had no direct experience in foreign policy. And there, the only thing to look for is whom he might appoint as Secretary of State, because there are compensations for that. LBJ.
Even though in his original statement, as firm a scoop is on the Russians, incidentally, I mean, it's over against Hughes.
Yeah.
And I could see where he and Scoop could get along together.
Yeah. I wouldn't think he'd appoint Scoop, though, as Secretary of State. No. No, I hope not. Anyway, I don't want to get into specifics. No, I think he doesn't talk about that as a specific outcome from this. But he does talk about a greater sense of compassion and need and recognition for the United States to use its resources in the world. Yeah, there's more talk about that ever since, and obviously in order to survive, he would have to have a larger vision, but there is some distance there to be made up. Yeah.
There was a short newspaper report of what he said to his adult class in Plains, Georgia, the Sunday after he got back last week, which said, "Without reading my Bible and understand things, don't expect God always to be on the outside. That's not the way it's told." So that was an interesting one. Maybe
true
to the fact that we would not be the self-righteous
policemen of the world. Yeah. I'd just as soon talk about what it means, you know, right now rather than projecting too far ahead, because who knows? I mean, if anybody had said, you know, just a few years ago that Gerald Ford had been president, they would have come, you know, with a basket. And because it seems so unlikely, because it was fascinating to hear E.R. Haldeman talk about what would have happened if they had never found the break-in, and he's convinced that in 1976 it would have been John Connally who would have been the Republican nominee. That'll tickle your toes, I'm sure.
You mentioned
anything more about his policy? Our general impression that he talks generality too, or your research and discovered?
Well, I didn't know I was going to do this until about 2 weeks before, and I wrote to the headquarters for position papers, and on a goodly number of papers, and I brought some comments here along, he has taken rather long specific stands, fair employment, public welfare programs, government creating government jobs and so on. Reorganization of the administration and so on, but he's asked this question all the time. Why don't you take more specific stands? Gary Wills has asked him, and Mike Novak, and goodness knows so many of the others, Hunter Thompson, and he has simply accepted the fact now that the press isn't going to repeat or isn't going to report all his detailed stands, but they are going to talk about his use of terms like twice-born experience. And has simply accepted that as a fact of life, and he's learned to live with the media that way without creating any hostility from them, because he's learned how the press turned against McGovern in '72, and the press was really quite sharp on McGovern, and even though he was the outsider challenging, you know, Goliath, and Carter simply avoiding that.
Who's he going to pick for vice president?
Well, he's going through the traditional and I think proper way of talking about looking at candidates from the different factions in the party so as to satisfy each faction in the party. And once having done that, maybe he knows already, but you have to go through this sort of ritual of saying you're looking at somebody from each section and unions and this and that. and it would make a great deal of difference. I have, you know, he only has about four or five advisors specifically who are close, and it would answer a lot of questions, you know, with this. But then on the other hand, we're always promised every 4 years, I'm a little skeptical, we're always promised about every 4 years that the vice president is really going to make a difference. And it didn't make any difference in under Eisenhower, it didn't make any difference under Kennedy, didn't make any difference under any of them, until Dixon resigned. There used to be articles, whatever happened to LBJ, you remember, that used to appear in the old Reporter and so on. And Rockefeller got so frustrated that he went back to buying art because there was nothing for him to do in Washington, and that was deliberate. So I'm not, you know, it gives you some sort of clue, but the vice president is cosmetic for either party. It isn't really an indication, I don't think, of, and there was no more cynical alliance than, you know, when Kennedy invited Johnson to the ticket in 1960. Talk about a shotgun wedding. That was it, which didn't tell us anything about Kennedy except that he wanted to be elected. And that's what did it, of course. So I don't think the vice presidency is all that useful. There will be people who say that it's going to be Adlai Stevenson because Daley has thundered out. And therefore, Carter isn't the anti-bureaucratic, anti-machine Kennedy he poses to be. But I'm rather skeptical about that. The amazing, well, I don't want to, yeah.
It doesn't seem to me that the usefulness of the vice presidency is the question anymore. I can't remember the exact number, but how many vice presidents have become the president in this century?
Well, in this century, quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
Truman, mm-hmm. Right? Well, I was starting back before then.
Yeah.
Let's see, it would have to be Hart, you know, what's his name, Coolidge. Coolidge became president, and then Truman, and, well, Nixon didn't in 60, although he became the nominee, and you can always talk about those votes in Illinois, if you like, in 1960, in Cook County and so on, and I see your point, but they still don't play it that way, so far as the vice presidency is concerned. They still pick somebody who will get votes rather than be the second best person in the gun, you know, in the party.
Interesting offshoot of Jimmy Carter's campaign is that in California, I think it's just been a local issue, but Governor Reagan bought time on television to express his religious views.
Huh?
I didn't get to see it, but he's ran, you know, twice and was successful and never cared to express, as far as I know, any particular views. And
what I'd like to throw out is, have we sort of decided that we're so sophisticated that our political leaders have avoided the kind of religious language that Carter uses, and suddenly we find out that we're not that sophisticated or cynical, but that we really want somebody who uses this, you know, this who comes forward with this kind of emphasis? Because we have, as I say, we haven't had this since Bryan. Is that a fair assessment, that we've simply underestimated or misjudged public opinion?
Don't you think it's more an offshoot of the Watergate and the other moral scandals that have been going on, and people simply want something better, perhaps? They think this is going to be the answer.
But why, you know, what would there be 11 viable, or as they like to call them, Democratic candidates, why pick this one?
Maybe because they believe he might not lie to it. I mean, we've been lied to quite often by presidents.
Yeah. Well, do you think that would be the key appeal to so many people? Is this matter of trust? Is that what he's been able to tap?
I think what you said about anti-politics is really important, because there's so little confidence in politics that a candidate that doesn't act like a candidate, people go, there's something special about that man. There's something different because he's not into the politics game, because he doesn't act like a politician. And he becomes much more real. But he doesn't wear fancy ties, so the, you know, older women will be attracted to the ties and that kind of stuff. He runs around in jeans and stuff.
I think
up here in the balcony.
Yeah, I actually.
actually think there's been a spiritual, you know, renewal in the last 5 or 6, 7 years, and I think that could be part of it. I don't think it's that the people have decided they like that kind of language. I think there's been a change in some part of the people as far as spiritual values, and I think that.
That, but how do I say that, the great disenchantment with much of the activism of the 60s was supposed to have, you know, led people to be rather cynical about the opportunity to really make significant changes in, you know, American life, and especially in the moral areas. And therefore, the 70s is supposed to be the what I like to call the trip inward. This is why TM is so popular, for instance, as sort of an escape sort of thing. And is Carter sort of an escape?
No, I think the trip inward has also come back again outward. I mean, I think there are Christians that went through the 60s, were disenchanted, looked inward, and were maybe inward for a while, and then they're coming out again. I mean, I think they're, maybe that's my own experience. Maybe that isn't what the rest of the country's gone through, but I've, at least that's where I've gone. And I think a lot of people that were very cynical in the 70s are much more positive, and I think a little bit more realistic. And they're not willing to just not even deal with the political system at all, you know.
Okay, now by contrast, in the primaries, you had a man like Morris Udall who took a very specific stand on almost all of the issues and tried to run on an issue thing rather than any other kind of emphasis, and he came out second or third best in each case. So there must be something in Carter beyond the idea that it's time to get back into, you know, a more activist phase, so far as the role of the federal government is concerned.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think it's partially the spiritual renewal in the last, you know, 6, 7 years. I don't know if anybody.
I was just wondering, do the rest of you pick up those vibrations or, mm-hmm. or not?
I wonder if it's spiritual renewal, maybe that, but maybe also kind of a religious legacy or heritage that's surfacing again in American history. You mentioned the Puritan thing, and that maybe there's a lot more of that in all of us that's been maybe repressed, or but is coming out again. And he talks our language. He's one of the folks. He's like we are.
Yeah, he's certainly grassroots. There's no question about that. There's no imperial presidency potential there, I don't think, at all. By contrast to certain other incumbents, you know, last eight to 10 years. I don't want to do all the talking. That's all.
I have a question.
Sure.
What do you think of this theology?
What I think of it?
We're talking now about response to it, but I think we ought to begin to think about whether or not it represents a more authentic or valid theology than present in most of the
Answer that first one by not by ducking it, but by using a point made by one of your colleagues, Martin Marty. Marty raised some questions about having Carter in the White House, because he said, with a person like Carter, what would happen if Carter said that God told me to do this? And it wasn't in the best interest of the country. But the higher allegiance, instead of to the Pope, it's, you know, to another biggie.
That's an unfair cut from Marty, because he's been very explicit all the way through on that one. And so was Harold Hughes. They cut Harold Hughes down on the same thing. And I feel very good. Like, when Marty was here, I said, can't you get a little more friendly with the Pentecostals and not just the Roman Catholics? I think I'm a Lutheran because I have to be both. How about being both, Marty? And I don't think he's sympathetic, like most of the Missouri Synod, to that kind of an expression. I am, like most of the Scandinavians.
What about the rest? Is it that we're not used to that kind of language, you know, coming from so high a, you know, a candidate? Yeah.
But if I heard you correctly, he has a structure to his theology. If he's really taken Niebuhr seriously, there are all kinds of principles that come out of that.
Yeah.
Guard against you simply going off on your own, the way that feels.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right, I did. I just threw out the Marty thing to see what would happen. Because if nothing else, you've got Congress to check. No matter who you have in the White House, you've always got Congress there. A lot of other people. No.
The issue is where the president's where the president.
Yeah, do you want to talk to that point? On Al's point? On the structure of his theology and whether or not that's what we want in a president? Well, I'm trying to avoid it.
That's the way scholars do. They tell us how to think about it.
Well, all I can say here is it's June 23rd, and I don't have to know until what is it, November 5th or 6th, and there'll be a lot more time to do this. I have to say, if you want my personal opinion right now, I don't know how I'd vote if it was Carter and Ford. I honestly don't know. With Ford, I know what we'd be getting in the next 4 years. I don't mean that sarcastically at all, because given the tremendous, you know, you never know when a new crisis is going to appear, you know, around the world or at home or somewhere else, and you know the kind of men Ford attracts and the kind of men he has around him and the kind of advice he'd be giving, and you have that kind of security and knowledge. But with Carter, you don't. Because this is one thing I'm looking very much, very carefully at, is what kind of advisors is he bringing in? Who is he bringing in? And so far, there's only the beginnings of what we call, you know, the shadow cabinet. And that will tell us a great deal who he's getting his ideas from. And so until that happens, I'm just simply waiting, because I don't know.
That's a very legitimate point. I was really asking you about his theology.
Yeah.
You might have a good theology, good theory, and in practical matters, just blow it and get people around and not be able to choose advisors like it. I was really asking the question that you were addressing primarily, namely, kind of the adequacy of his theological view here.
Well,
sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Get your
I think he has, you know, into the Christian realism thing, he certainly has a clear understanding of the contending forces at work and how difficult it is to establish any kind of, you know, equity among the different competing economic forces at work in any society, and that he seems to come down so far more on the side of the less wealthy and the less powerful. He can't be accused of having grown up born to wealth, for instance, and being so familiar with it that he's insensitive to others. Because the only reason he could, the only way he could get, for instance, into college was to, you know, to get a free ride, namely Annapolis. So I think there is that to be said in his favor coming out of his theology, which I think he'd be willing to take on, you know, some of the vested interests. He doesn't seem to be dependent so far on any major group so far as his financial support is concerned, which I think is remarkable.
One thing, Erling, that I get a little bit from you, and maybe that's what we're getting a little bit, is it because he has a Christian heart that he doesn't have a tough mind. I see him as very tough-minded, but with a remarkable likability at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a strange combination for somebody to be as tough-minded as he is and to be as likable as he is.
Yeah,
that's why I kind of looked at him as a possible man of the hour.
They're charming.
Well, they, you know, we don't know enough yet, and I'm not trying to pass the buck, but we don't know enough, but those who are critical, there was a good piece in Harper's in April, say that he does have a fierce temper, and that once crossed, he can make life very uncomfortable for some of his aides, and one of his aides says that he always wants everything done, you know, like yesterday, and he's very unhappy when things aren't done well. He has a great need, a great liking for and penchant for efficiency. Which would be something remarkable. And that he drives himself very hard. And he is a self-made man, and that isn't necessarily always a compliment. And and that since he is, he might have trouble with other people. This is, you know, there is a contradiction, because on the other hand, he has helped, you know, minority groups a great deal, and yet he prides himself on what he's done in terms of his own, you know, career, because he started from nothing, and takes great satisfaction in having accomplished all this on the basis of mostly of hard work and careful planning. Because one of the things that's the most remarkable about his campaign is the very effective grassroots work done on the local level. For instance, in Iowa, they were ready. The Carter people were ready in Iowa for everything, and nobody else was ready. And they went to Iowa first, because that was the first state, even before New Hampshire, that got, you know, headlines. And they picked, let's see, Iowa, Florida, and New Hampshire as target states way back about 2 years ago, and started working. And they had volunteers coming up from Georgia. Maybe some of you remember these in some of these states, where these people would work free, simply ringing doorbells and getting out the literature and all the rest, and ironclad discipline with these people, an enormous enthusiasm and an openness and a willingness which a lot of people hadn't seen before. And hence, I think, in that sense, right, very well organized and tightly disciplined, and tremendous inner motivation, which he would have to have in order to, you know, like Colson, we listened this afternoon, in order to stand the, you know, the criticism and the ridicule which a lot of people have made already of him.
What about his record as governor?
So far, it's I can only rely there on the evaluations of people who are, how should I say this, well into politics. And Andrew Young, well, a person I respect very much, is very sympathetic towards his record as governor in terms of the accomplishments for reorganization of the state, cutting back on the bureaucracy, cutting back on taxes, and taking on some of the interests, as I say, like the real estate, so far as tax exemptions and all the rest were concerned. The only serious criticism, and it has to be taken seriously, coming from another Georgian politician, is Julian Bond. And 2 weeks after Young's piece in Nation, Julian Bond said, "Why, I don't support Jimmy Carter." And his argument was that Carter really is working right through the political system, that he really is working with the Maddoxes and the Dailies and the others, and that he doesn't see any great difference other than the, you know, the language which is used.
Julian Bond see the possibility of our even usability of the present establishment. I mean, I've heard him for 2 hours one night,
yeah,
and he certainly is radically opposed to the whole business.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah, I agree.
He's playing the game.
Yeah.
But the whole thing, he's doing it against the strongest union we've got, the government workers.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are going to hurt the most if he gets in.
Yeah. Right. No, I wish I knew more, but it's been this kind of funny kind of campaign, and really, in a sense, it's a test of us more than it's a test of Carter, because we react to Carter on the basis of our own interests and our own tendencies and our own preferences. And many of us would like far more concrete, specific stands on issues, and we tend to therefore become suspicious of Carter when he doesn't have them, or the press won't report them, or whatever might be the case, and think that much of the religious language, for instance, is just, you know, so much gimmickry. On the other hand, there are large, large numbers of Americans who don't want that sort of thing, and who really are looking for the good man, in office, just like they've looked for so long, looking for a crusade, looking for a revival, if you want to put it in that way. This is always a successful theme that you can tap. You remember Clean as a Houndstooth in 1952? That we were told, and it worked. Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, back in 1912, the revival crusade kind of approach, and therefore Carter. You'd say that Carter really is interested, you know, in getting elected, and then all the other is just window dressing. And on the other people, hear him talk and know of his record. Know of his sister, for instance, who has a well-known ministry in throughout the country. And want this kind of candidate, and want rather simple, direct, no-nonsense kinds of of appeal, and aren't put off by his open sort of demonstration of his personality. They aren't interested in debating the issues; they're simply interested in their own gut reactions.
Have you seen any comment by the old guard of Christianity today?
Very guarded. The old guard in the Christianity Today said we shouldn't vote for a person just because he's a born-again Christian, but they have to. I'm rather cynical about Lindzel. Well, anyway, I think they're trying to protect their tax-exempt status, because Christianity and Crisis lost it when they endorsed McGovern in '72, And that hurt that magazine a great deal. So I think they have to do this. But they're, so far, the first editorial they've stated is, you know, fearlessly straight down the middle. uncompromising moderation. Yeah. Dave?
Well, in response to the question of why the Carter phenomenon,
yeah.
I vote for the trust thing. For one reason, Carter's a charming man when he appears on TV. I wouldn't ordinarily, I don't think, go out of my way to find a Southern Democrat to support. But I see the man, and I'm charmed by him. One of the reasons I think that happens is that certainly with the Watergate debacle and other things, is that politicians who have been more in the public eye are getting caught in changing their positions, obviously to get elected. In the state of Washington, we've had a Scoop Jackson, of course, who the downtown business community has supported pretty solidly for many years. And all of a sudden, we observe him making comments that are seeming surprising, and in some cases, almost contradictions of previous positions, simply because he's running for president. And we become suspicious of that kind of activity. Yeah. Now, Carter has not been in the public eye, so he hasn't gotten trapped in that in large numbers, at least. And I think that when the Nixon administration got caught up, and I think in arrogance, among other things, that the people were really looking for someone they could trust as a man, and the position papers don't get read anyway, except by a very few researchers. And that you get an initial reaction to a candidate, yeah. and I think in this climate, if we trust him, we'll vote for him.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, it's true what some people have said, that people don't care if he's liberal or conservative, that those are, so far as we can tell now, meaningless categories anymore by which to run. McGovern certainly didn't get anywhere in 72 by trying.
There are two principles that I have followed at any vote. One is the social policy or the social philosophy of the candidate, and the other is the social policy and the social philosophy of the party. And I think this country, if you want to know why people vote, I think they vote for a long reason to the only time. And the wrong reasons are reasons of some attractiveness of the candidate, or the goodwill of the candidate, or the personal virtues of the candidate. And what the government is about is the formation and actualization of a social policy. And that's the problem with Carter. I don't know much more. I don't know any more than you've said
earlier
about that.
Well,
I don't know whether it's possible. Maybe you've got the stuff that you indicated.
Well, I wish I had all his papers. I don't. I mean, his position papers. I think he is a centrist. And as a centrist, he has to avoid getting caught in pitfalls. He almost got into one. You remember, I'm surprised the ethnic purity thing hasn't come up. And that was, of course, the death, for instance, you remember, of George Romney, with a famous brainwashing comment and so on. And Carter studied that. His aides have studied, you know, previous campaigns very carefully, and with the exception of the ethnic purity thing, have avoided those things. And as a centrist, he is trying now to build public support behind them. And then, and I see your point. I'm simply stating his. He says once he's got public support behind him, then he has the mandate to go ahead. And what he's looking for is what you're you know, and he's bidding for is what, you know, what you have. And I have to say myself, I remember so well those press conferences when in the mid 1960s about the war in Vietnam, and when you stop to look at the caliber of people who were running the government in the mid 1960s, and you have the president of the Ford Company, you had the dean of Harvard, You had a large number of intellectuals who were in charge of running the war. And I've been a little bit suspicious. You remember McNamara with his famous overlays. And because McNamara said if we did 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, we could produce a Mustang, which would sell, or whatever car was selling for Ford at that time. And therefore, the war should be fought in the same way. If we do this and that much and, you know, the other thing, it's bound to, you know, end the war. And what, you know, what McNamara overlooked completely was the human spirit. He had no way in which to cope with that because you don't build Fords that way. You don't get, you know, an effective product out that way, and Ford couldn't cope with that, and all the cost benefits analyses and all the rest couldn't do this. So I've become I'm not saying that, you know, I want to go over too far the other direction, because I would like to know a great deal more about the specifics of Carter, but I'm not altogether sure that we've proved that getting the best minds in the country is necessarily going to lead to the best policies, because what we had under Kennedy and Johnson before Nixon came into office was a few group of people, you know, we precious few, who felt, I mean, talk about the imperial presidency, it started there, who felt they knew so much about it they didn't have to be responsible to anybody else. And you can tick them off, Rostow, Schlesinger, Bundy, McNamara. I'm not trying to set up an anti-intellectual dichotomy here in the country, but...
Social philosophy has to do with intellect all the time, or just being intellectual.
Yeah.
You know, what does a candidate, I don't know, what does he stand for, what does he support, what's he behind? And if he gets into office and people that are appointed by him, what are they going to advocate to push? How are they going to take buses? Civil rights, whatever issues that were economy in terms of how government spending. Now I know you can't get into specifics, and I don't mean to do that, but I mean in terms of a general social philosophy, doesn't necessarily go being just a particular intellect.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I agree. That's valid qualification. Right. I Carter's obviously going the other route. And it's gotten them to where he is. And it tells us, I think, something about our, you know, about ourselves. That's all I'm trying to say, is that Carter tells us more about ourselves, I think, than anything else, the way we responded to him. How, in one sense, it's a sign of real health, because you don't have to be, well, either one, as I said before, born to great wealth, or have an extensive exposure to the public, or have a skillful group of well-known political pros, like Larry O'Brien, for instance. You remember the old Irish Mafia from Kennedy's days, and the argument always was that you had to have skillful managers behind you, a well-known trusty, old Jim Farley types, and so on. And Carter comes along with a very amateur, you know, operation, and wins.
His campaign is amateur. I think that he's been
planning it for many years. No, but amateur in the sense that he's not dependent on the party. They say his three or four closest aides are as tough and as hardworking and as shrewd as any political.
Right.
You know, they come on as sweet talking South Georgians, but they're just as tough as Larry O'Brien or O'Connell or any of the Irish Mafia ever were.
Yeah.
But they aren't part of the old establishment up in Washington, working out of party headquarters. Right, and they're not Strauss. They're not.
I think that's part of the trust that has not sold out to certain vested interests.
Well, that
I'd like to see a grassroots campaign.
Yeah, this is a real one. This is just as much a one as Bryan's was, really, because it's not dependent on the old conventional wisdom for what it does, and that's the remarkable thing about it.
Why did Bryan lose? And might those dynamics still apply?
Well, he...
Money. I mean, silver dollar was over against him more than
anything. Yeah, he oversimplified. You know, in one way, there's a parallel, because he oversimplified. He called, remember, for old ratio of 16 to 1 in gold and silver. And, of course, he didn't have Marcus Hanna, you know, bankrolling him as McKinley did in 1896. In the 1900s, he lost because of the war, because the war was popular, and Bryan was anti-war. He was, you know, CO and all the rest. And in 1908, I can't even remember. Oh, I can't remember 1908 anymore. But they didn't have, you know, the times were entirely different because we didn't have television and the power of the media really in those days, more than anything else. But Carter's funny because he in a way he's grassroots, but he doesn't really overplay anything. This is one thing, I don't know if, he doesn't really, except for ethnic purity, he hasn't really made any big mistakes. He doesn't come on too strong in any one direction. He'll go into unions, but then he'll go, you know, into other areas too. I mean, in the union districts, but he'll go into other districts. And somehow he gets by with it.
Well, if you don't state yourself in specific terms, you leave yourself open to any kind of position once you're elected.
Yeah, well, we talked about that before. He has made rather many specific issues, but the press has been ignoring it for the most part. And because they're enchanted with the other image of him. And for instance, in the last, I think it's May 6th issue of Time, or no, Newsweek, which is over here, they have a whole page on as much as you can get onto one page. On busing, he's been clear. On abortion, he's clear. On amnesty, housing, public housing, full employment. I don't know what. I mean, you know, this is sort of a progress report more than anything else, but I do think it tells us that it's a moment in American, you know, political history when there are some very significant changes taking place, and I'm sure that when the deck has been shuffled again completely, it'll look entirely different. Would you ever, you know, because you have to think in back with a little bit of perspective here, Nixon got the largest vote of popular majority of any public, you know, politician in history. You know, and now he's, you know, writing his memoirs. It's a strange, of course, that was self-inflicted. I mean, there's no question there.
All those who voted for him are beginning to leave.
You said at the beginning you were going to say something about the junior senator from Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, that Humphrey really kept waiting, you know, for lightning to strike out there at, his little home on
Waverly,
right. And that he was tired, of course, he didn't want to, he'd been campaigning ever since, you know, 1944, he's been shaking hands. And Muriel really was just plain tired, I mean, there's no question. And so he kept waiting for this idea that the party will, that the primaries will lead to stalemate and that he'll be above the fray and that he'll be able to step in without having to go around and do anything. And suddenly he had just simply been outworked by the Carter forces. He was left at the starting gate completely from the beginning, and I sense a sense of relief in him. I mean, having just come from Minnesota a week ago and all the statements and everything, I think he's kind of happy about the whole thing. The only people who were unhappy in Minnesota were all the people who were waiting for him to move up so they could move up a step, mm-hmm. like Governor Anderson and some of the others.
Even up until the last minute, you anticipated that he was going.
Yeah, but I remember hearing on PBS that he made a third final statement, you know, on what he was going to do. Like, who was it, Sarah Bernhardt, the great actress? How many times did she give her farewell performance? And Humphrey just can't stay away. I he's just that way. He just can't stay out of the, you know, the limelight. I don't know what else to say about it.
That would have caused some change in political thinking if that would have worked that way.
Yeah, two things of why I think he didn't run. It was Frank Wright in the Minneapolis Tribune who had it, that say he had lost in New Jersey. It would have been a real setback to him personally. Right. And say he had gotten the nomination but was split the party, which I think would have happened because the Carter people were very strong, and the Carter people, I think, could vote just as easily for Ford if it's Humphrey over there, because they see Carter more as a moderate rather than a liberal. And then he would have lost, or then he would never would have had a chance to be Senate Majority Leader, and that's the one last thing he wants. And now he's already announced for that. And so he just didn't dare risk either splitting the party or losing being Senate Majority Leader.
Have you seen, or anyone seen, any precedents for a support of candidates coming out with religious convictions like this on local levels?
It all depends on the local, which precinct you represent. I mean, there's no particular trend. You're going to be a Mormon if you're in Salt Lake City, you know, and you're going to be a Norwegian Lutheran if you're in the first district of Minnesota. We haven't had anything except the Norwegian Lutheran ever since 1858, and that's the first year they were electing people in from the first district in Minnesota. That's my district. That's Alcuy. And it depends. You have a Catholic in St. Paul, and you have a Protestant in Minneapolis, because Catholic, St. Paul's entirely Catholic, and you know, and who was it? Gene McCarthy had the best one about the Democratic Party in New York City. He said it represents the 3I League. Some of you remember way back in the old days in baseball, there was a sort of a semi-pro league from Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa. They called it the 3I League. And to have a ticket that will win in New York City, it's the 3I League, Italy, Israel, and Ireland. And sure enough comes Levy and Leskowitz and, you know, O'Brien or something like that. And, I don't know. It's a strange, I'm still not sure.
I still like to ask a question that you sure. asked. Why are people, you know, responding to the spiritual language, or the,
yeah.
that type of religious terminology? Is there another candidate that could have generated the trust that wouldn't have used that type of language, or, you know, it's
well,
what is the factor behind that?
Where I'm at right now is this business that Carter is totally sincere. I don't think he's changed his stance at all on his religious convictions, and it's one of these rare moments where you get the climate for this sort of thing and the candidate at the same time. He wouldn't have gotten to first base in 1972. Or even a few years before, but it happened to be in the post-Watergate depression that comes along in the cynicism, and I think things like Wayne Hayes and the rest are going to help Carter, mm-hmm. because Ford's been in Congress for 25 years. I mean, he's obviously straight, but he still has guilt by association sort of thing, and I think it is this rare combination. And now people are saying when I see Carter coming along like that, that obviously since he is a politician, it's all calculated, it's all phony. I think he's fudged on a lot of issues. I'd like to have a lot more information for him on, for instance, on foreign policy, a lot more. But that aside, I don't think he has. I think he has been, honest with the people, and that they're looking at him because he represents something which they think is what the country needs at this time. There is sort of a cutback. This is why Jerry Brown. I don't know. People from California tell me they have different perceptions of him than we do. But Brown comes off very popular because he comes out as lowering taxes, and cutting back. Less is less, kind of approach, and living in an apartment and riding a bicycle and that sort of thing is what a lot of people want. And Brown has been able to capitalize on that in the largest state in population in the country. And candidates are running on this sort of, program, and Carter's been able to capitalize on this more than any of the others. Whereas Udall, who's very solid on all the issues, can't get away from the idea, from the charge of being a big spender. And Church was the same way. And Church comes across in sort of a born-again fashion, too. He's a very direct kind of approach in his, he was too late. And he just looks square. He really does. Yeah?
Do you mean to imply that all these 30 or 40 million people who are Carter supporters all support him because of his religious views?
I think so.
You don't feel that he has support from the Jewish community? Or
yes, he does some. It depends. I was going to go. I've got a long thing on if the Jewish thing came up on this. But I think they're looking to them. The big issues, the concrete issues, are the general moral issues. That's the point I was trying to make. That's why they aren't worried that he doesn't take a strong stand, or doesn't. We don't know about his strong stands on concrete issues because they're looking for something else. So far as we know now, the Jewish community is not hostile towards him. I've got a long quotation here from Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, so I can remember his title. He's Director of Interfaith Relations for the American Jewish Congress. That is, he's the PR to Protestant and Catholic groups. And Tannenbaum has come out and saying he's reasonably sympathetic towards what Carter has said so far as it represents Jewish interests in this country. He's not worried about it or bothered by it. And the Jewish people in Atlanta are very enthused about Carter.
So you mean that you feel that people who, say the Jewish or Catholic people, or people who are non-religious, that the religious element in Carter appeals to them as an indication of his sincerity?
Yes.
Or moral fiber?
Yeah, exactly.
I think
it's
a lot of it is appealing to moralism.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's
a lot of feeling of a need for a kind of moralism, whether it's religious or not. And we'd like to have somebody be kind of good for a change,
yeah.
and not to be running around in Washington and and condoning all that.
Yes.
Loose living.
Right, really, and you know, it came up. A lot of people were very bothered when they found out about what President Kennedy had been doing, you know, between appointments in the White House, and so it wasn't just Nixon, but it was, you know, Kennedy too. And I think I read one analysis of why Carter is so popular in black communities, and he has tremendous black support, and that is that many of them feel very strongly that the only way in which the black community, the black people, can get anywhere is through hard work and thrift and diligence and the old-fashioned virtues. And they found out that many of the government programs, the welfare programs and all the rest, are simply to buy them, to keep them quiet. And especially and this is what Andrew Young himself says directly, and that Carter can tap this sense of a need for sort of a moral reawakening and a concern for these issues again. And this raises the eternal question. This is why I'm glad it came up. The question that Al was raising too is the question in between, you know, the good man on the one hand, the man you can trust, and on the other hand, having a clear-cut program so you know exactly what you're buying. The British go far more towards the other system, where they don't do much in terms of personality or in terms of the individual themselves, but it's almost exclusively on the basis of, you know, the platform. And if you don't like the platform, you know, out you go. And of course, they have a much better system because they can have an old general election in 3 weeks. And we take 3 years to get people cranked up for office, and so we you know, for reasons which, you know, we could go into if you like, we're much more prone towards looking at the individual rather than on the platform. You know, I'm often worried about this because I think back, why is it that at a campaign, the opposition party never goes back and says, well, the other party promised us all these things 4 years ago, because we don't hear about those things. We're going to hear a lot in the next 2-3 weeks about platforms, and isn't that nice? But really, when it comes right down to it, the platforms really don't think make that much difference. I'd like to believe that, and in the British parliamentary system they really do. Or in the Scandinavian systems, they're far more concerned with issues. I always remember this, or in the German, this marvelous one with Willy Brandt when he was running for Chancellor of West Germany. And he simply announced his itinerary. And somebody noticed that his wife and family weren't going along. And some American, I think. And they were shocked by this. And Willy, you know, answered, you know, what did they have to do with the issues? Yeah. But in America, we've got to have, you know, the wife and the family out there all the time in front of everybody. Because we want to, you know, see what kind of a family man he is. And the president's Christmas card is always a picture of the family. Because if he's a good family man, he's most likely a good man. But that's the way we look at them. And Betty Ford's a good dancer. And, you know, there is a button out now, vote for Betty's husband. Mm-hmm. You know, which is kind of cute.
He's the best
dancer he's got. Yeah, he is. Although she almost blew it there on marijuana for a while, but she was honest and direct, and I think that's what the people liked about her, that she was honest about that issue.
Well, and Carter has more appeal to more groups who have not in the past felt that they had some...
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is blue-collar, is that blue-collar people are tired of George Meany and Frank Fitzsimmons telling them how to vote. Really, there's no one... I don't think there's any such thing, really, except on local issues as a union vote anymore, or blue-collar work. Maybe there is for a mayor or an alderman or something, but on a national basis, I don't think so. At all. There's no such thing as a youth vote anymore. What we found out in 1972 was that the highest proportion in terms of age groups who voted for George Wallace, 21 to 29-year-olds. So much for the liberal youth vote in this country. More than any other group, they voted for Wallace. And I think that's a very good point, that Wallace appeals to the dispossessed and those who have been out of it. They feel out of it for a while, and they can really get in touch with him. And I mean, he is authentic grassroots, just like Brian was.
Carter
was, yeah. Carter was, I'm sorry. Carter was, yeah, very much. So, it's going to be fun to follow. I'm sorry, we're going to be up here. Maybe we can pipe in his acceptance speech. It's the campaign, the nomination convention starts July 12th, if I'm not mistaken. And I don't think it'll be much, there'll be too much interest. There'll be, Eric Severide will be pondering, you know, with that big furrowed brow and worrying over things. He always worries over things. I think that's an old, you know, Norwegian piety in him or something that's gone wrong somewhere. But and William S., you know, what's his name, Theodore White, will be finding great historical precedents for all this sort of thing, and I don't think it means a, you know, blessed thing. It's a media, that's a big media event, but yeah. That's another story. Well, anyway, 10:30, and tomorrow's another day.